Hello and welcome to the Brewin podcast. This week we return to the subject matter of Brexit, discussing the roadmap for the proposed parliamentary votes next week and then what the ramifications might be for the UK economy and UK assets. Now, at this point, it's well worth highlighting that on the Brewin Dolphin LinkedIn page, our head of research, Guy Foster, delivers an animated video presentation detailing how the various factions within Parliament are likely to vote in each circumstance. And it's well worth checking out at only 7 minutes long. But returning to our 20-minute update on Brexit, the economy and markets, please keep listening. But first, here are our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. I'm Ben Gutteridge, Head of Fund Research, and today we're going to be revisiting the subject of Brexit on the basis that we now have a series of votes scheduled for next week, and to discuss the potential outcomes and the ramifications for the UK economy and UK assets, we are welcomed by Brexit expert Guy Foster, our head of research. Guy, welcome back to the podcast, and sorry to keep bringing you back only to talk about Brexit. I know there's so many other things that you're well versed and prepared to talk about, but it is an important subject.
Well, that's all right. I'll just go rogue anyway.
Right, okay, well you take it where you want to go, but let's start on Brexit and talk us through the series of votes, and I may interrupt you, but talk us through the series of votes and the way in which they are seemingly set to go and why.
So next week we will have three votes. I think everyone knows this. Yep. On the 12th we'll have what is bound to be a meaningful vote. There was potential for it to happen earlier. Unsurprisingly, it didn't happen earlier. That will be a vote on the Prime Minister's deal. We don't know what that deal looks like, but we've been rather uncharitably describing it as May's deal with lipstick, meaning that it's probably going to be very similar to the previous deal, but with some fairly cosmetic changes to it, designed to provide some cover to allow people to vote for it who previously had rejected it. So that's the 12th. If that were not to be passed, we'll then have a vote on the 13th, which is an opportunity for Parliament to say that, having rejected the deal, it would like to leave the European Union without a deal. And then if that were not passed, then in keeping with the narrative that we've held for some months now, one of three things has to have happened by the 29th of March. So if it's not a deal, it's not no deal, then it has to be an extension. So Parliament will be given the opportunity to vote approving an extension to the negotiating period. So obviously it's Parliament, so there's a theoretical possibility that it could reject all of those options. But regardless of what Parliament says, one of those three things has to have happened by the 29th of March.
Okay, so let's take each of those votes in turn. We'll start with the withdrawal agreement, Theresa May's deal. What level of quality of lipstick, I'm thinking cosmetic, what level of cosmetic surgery is this deal going to have received? I mean, I guess we're all eyes are on Geoffrey Cox here.
It would be very minor cosmetic surgery. Yeah. I mean, the kind of thing you might do
consider myself
in any given month, rather than the sort of life-changing surgery that I know you've been saving up for quite some time. So I think that really is the question that we've been waiting, been wondering what the answer was going to be. Geoffrey Cox went over to the EU. He was in the process of trying to negotiate a change to the withdrawal agreement, and the ambition here was certainly that he would want something he could bring back to Parliament, and he would say, my previous legal advice was that the UK could theoretically, but probably not, get stuck in the backstop arrangement with the EU. That was perceived as being one of the major reasons so many people voted against the Prime Minister's deal. So what he wanted to be able to do was come back and say, actually, with this codicil, with this amendment, with whatever it is I've negotiated, I can now say that it is not possible for the EU to get stuck in the backstop arrangement. That was his ambition. During the negotiating period, these three votes were announced. Now, whether it's because of that announcement or in spite of them, I think it's reasonable to say his hand would have been weakened quite significantly. The other thing that happened was the Labour Party came out in favour of a second referendum as their preferred option. So both of those things probably, I think it's reasonable to say, they probably diminished the EU's desire, motivation to concede a lot of stuff. And so the sound bites that we're getting support that, saying it seems like he's going to come back with a very thin veneer of makeup to apply to the deal.
So it doesn't pass on that basis. That would be the core view. But what happens if he does, Guy? What happens if he does get a surprisingly strong reassurance from the EU, remote as that may be? You know, what does that mean in Parliament?
Well, the first thing that would happen is I would pick myself up off the floor, together with a lot of other people, I suspect, as well. It's not really, I think if there isn't a significant change, then that you're not going to get a passage of this vote. If there is a significant change, then it is, we estimate that you could get to about 300 votes in favour of the deal. And that's on the assumption that the DUP is satisfied with it. If the DUP aren't satisfied with it, then I think it's got no chance of passing. But that would be on the assumption that you've probably still got a hardline group of Conservative MPs who won't support it, who aren't concerned about the backstop. They're concerned about how closely it ties us to the EU. Regardless, you would attract a handful, maybe five or six Labour MPs who have always been more kind of Brexit-centric. I think you can lure back into the fold a lot of European research group members who are kind of conceding, realizing the way the ground is moving under the Brexit issue, that actually even though they may not like this deal, it's the most feasible way of getting any kind of Brexit done that can be clearly visualized at this stage. So that's how you might be able to get to that kind of number. Then I think there would be a reasonable number, 20, maybe a few more, of Labour MPs who would abstain. So they wouldn't vote against it because they don't want to have to return to their potentially Leave voting constituencies and say that they voted against Brexit. That's bad politics for them. And I'm sure some of them are also pretty, believe in the cause of Brexit as well. So that would be about 20 abstentions. But obviously the party whip, the Labour whip, is going to be, at least on the face of it, saying you've got to vote against this, because the Labour's policy now is to pursue a second referendum. So whilst privately I suspect Jeremy Corbyn desperately wants this to be over, and probably wouldn't mind losing just so that he can return to safer territory, that their party's stance needs to be to vote against it. And so I think that means there'll probably be about 25 or so votes against, and that makes it difficult for it to pass.
And on the basis of the next vote, we're going to talk about the no deal, whether Parliament is in favour of leaving the European Union without a deal. Given that that's in the schedule, in the timetable, presumably some Remain-leaning Tory MPs will be thinking, well, I don't need to vote support this deal out of fear of a chaotic, disorderly no-deal Brexit, to sort of paraphrase their opinions, because they can stop it, they can prevent a no-deal with their following day's vote.
Well, I think, yes, yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly the case. So the difficulty is, if you shift, if the centre of gravity of Brexit shifts towards Remain, then you might kind of force some levers to cling to the only Brexit ship that happens to be leaving port. But at the same time, you've got a few more of the sort of soft Brexit stroke Remain orientated MPs jumping back onto the dock, believing the ship doesn't have to sail at all.
I love it, Guy. Great stuff. Okay, so we get to the vote for no deal. Let's say that, yeah, the withdrawal agreement doesn't pass. We're on to the day for voting. Do you support no deal? Which way is Theresa May going to encourage her party to vote on this?
That is, for a vote that she herself has called, it's remarkably difficult to know how she is going to play this one. I mean, in a sense, it probably doesn't matter. It's a choice between asking her party to vote to leave without a deal and being defeated by her party, or willfully diminishing her own negotiating position by asking her party to vote.
So free vote to reject. Is that the solution?
Well, she could do a free vote, and then
but she still have to reveal her vote. There's nothing anonymous about this. She could abstain.
Yes, yeah, I mean, okay. We would know what she's done. Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So there's no good options for her under those circumstances. I think the saving grace is that the whole point of her insistence that no deal is an option is that it needed to be in order to get the best deal from the negotiations. And for the second time now, she'll be maintaining that the negotiations have now finished, and therefore it's essentially time to approve her deal. So if she votes against no deal, if her party votes against no deal, it doesn't matter because there is a deal, it's there for taking, and she has quite rightly pointed out, the only real way to take no deal off the table is to approve the deal.
Or to
withdraw Article 50, but the most conceivable way of taking no deal off the table is to approve the deal. But the vote itself won't do that.
And the whip mechanism is pretty broken anyway at the moment. So the way what she says doesn't really influence, we don't think, too much of the way the House votes. So will Parliament support no deal?
No.
So we move to the next day. Will Parliament support an extension?
Yes.
So we've got a pretty high conviction view then. Withdrawal agreement fails. Not enough support for no deal. Enough support for an extension. But we don't have the authority then to determine how long the extension is. But presumably we're going to be requesting a 3-month extension just to sort of cross the I's and dot the T's.
Yeah, that's what they've said. That's what this vote is ostensibly about. It's about requesting an extension that is supposed to be a short extension, that's supposed to wrap it all up before the parliamentary elections in May. But you're quite right. Everyone knows if we ask for an extension, we will have to take the extension we're given, or decide to leave without a vote, without a deal, which is probably something that was rejected by Parliament on the preceding day.
Is it sort of worth something, I was talking political tactics here, but is it something that Theresa May is sort of leaking inadvertently via Ollie Robbins that, you know, whilst we might only ask for a 3-month extension, this could turn into a 21-month extension in order to help get the deal over the line next on the 12th?
Well, it could be. But at the same time, we go, you know, if that's perhaps an invitation for me to use my ship dock jumping overboard kind of analogy again.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it may help get some Brexiteers on board, but it probably pushes a few Remainers back onto the quay. So I'm not sure it materially helps the cause. And it's been difficult to differentiate between incompetence and strategy during this whole negotiation process, but it's tended to be it's tended to look more likely that it's incompetence rather than strategy.
Okay, so let's take two scenarios, because we want to come back to investment markets Let's take scenario one and encompass within scenario, let's call it scenario A. Within scenario A, there's two potential outcomes. One is that the deal passes on the 12th of May. Another is
and
that
B.
There is, and the next is that there is a short, relatively short extension, let's say 3 months, and just to tie up a few loose ends and the deal passes. So let's say by June or July, let's say by July, we're out of the European Union with a withdrawal agreement signed. Let's talk about that as one scenario. And then the second scenario is that we're looking at a 21-month extension. So what is, you know, what is the shape of the UK economy at the moment? I guess that will help answer both parts. But what is the shape of the UK economy, and what does that mean if we get a deal sorted?
The UK economy is it has sort of fragile sentiment, but actually relatively robust levels of activity, supported by slightly flimsy financials and a real lack of investment. So people are spending enough and businesses have been hiring. The labour market's very tight, but surveys quite frequently, not unanimously, have suggested there's a bit of uncertainty, a bit of weakness, a bit of fragility to it. And obviously that spending has largely come as a result of a falling savings rate. But the general tightness of the economy, of the labour market, has really kept activity ticking over. And just to put it into context, unemployment is obviously very low at the moment. In fact, it's below the level at which it should be leading to inflation, that the Nairu, as economists call it, is the furthest below that of any of the G7 economies. So in many ways, we've got the tightest labour market in the developed world, tighter than the US, tighter than Japan. We've got employment growing at about 500,000 a year. So and it's been doing that, you know, close to that level for 6 years. So it's the fastest and most sustained pace of employment expansion since records began, certainly in my lifetime. And the employment
since
rate...
Since the 50s. Sorry, carry on.
And the employment rate has risen to over 75% of the population, or of the economically active population. That is the highest it's ever been as well, or since records began. So, I mean, in many ways, In the age in which I grew up, which was the 1980s, for clarity, then, you know, the kind of stats you've got from the labour market, from inflation, would be nirvana to economists. It would be described as an economic miracle. But times have moved on, and so now we tend to look for things much more like, the current account balance, which is heavily in deficit, the budget balance, which is in a modest deficit. The savings rate, which is very low. It's those kind of things which are quite fragile, and that's why I can't say it's got some underlying fragility to it. But it is but the activity levels are very strong. And the thing, to come back to your question, so that's the shape of the economy. If a Brexit deal was concluded, then none of that is likely to go away. But instead, you would unlock what really appears to be to exist, which is a lot of pent-up investment that no one wants to make because they're not really sure of the UK's future trading relationship. That's why I think the second half of 2019 would, under that rather unlikely scenario that you described, be really quite robust for the UK, probably also encompassing higher interest rates.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you sort of heard Mark Carney's latest comments, but he did seem to suggest the market is under appreciating how much interest rates could go up this year. Not by a great, I think it's sort of one or two.
Yeah.
It could go up one or two times from here. But of course, he is a Brexit. He's very concerned about Brexit, isn't he?
Yes. I mean, he was also very clear that we don't know what he thinks about Brexit, but I think we all probably think we do know what he thinks about Brexit. I think that's right. And he also, he maintains that actually there could be a rate rising scenario in a no deal Brexit situation as well. I mean, I think that's much less likely, but that's what he maintains. And the fundamentals, as I described, very tight labour market, a and the changes that are going to take place, even though they probably won't take effect this year, are to restrict restrict inflows of labour yet further. So it all supports higher interest rates.
So if a deal gets done, what sort of upside do you see in sterling based on the strength of the economy and policy rates being far too generous for that that's normal circumstances?
Well, I mean, I think probably sort of 5 to 10%, which sounds
not huge.
Sounds pretty pathetic under the circumstances. I mean, maybe they could go a bit further than that, but the sort of fundamental undervaluation of sterling is pretty modest at the moment. I mean, it's clearly cheap relative to the US, but I don't think it's sort of stunningly so. I mean, it's in the context of, we've seen it being, say, 30 to 40% overvalued before the financial crisis, and typically around about 10% fundamentally overvalued for a sustained period following that. Now it looks about 5% cheap. You know, could it go all the way back to its sort of typical 10% premium? Yeah, I mean, it could do. Obviously, to a certain extent, that would depend what's going on elsewhere.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about scenario B, or two, as I described it all that time ago. Let's say we are not holding quite as strong a hand as we thought, and that we have to succumb to a 21-month extension to the deal. Is that enough, do you think, to attract that FDI? Or indeed, you know, what are the things that you would consider would drive economic performance from there and sterling and interest rates?
Well, I think it would be the same. I think we would be much more beholden to the forces outside the UK, because ultimately it's still difficult to unlock FDI and internal investment as well when that uncertainty lingers on. So, yeah, I mean, that's the much shorter answer to that question, that basically we would still have high levels of activity for now and so on, but we would be reliant upon there being a decent volume of external demand to keep things ticking over. You know, we can't generate much more internal demand because the savings rate's already quite low. Therefore, you're looking for pickup in Europe, pickup in Asia, things that we talk about, you know, quite frequently.
Is there a concluding thought you could give us, Guy, on what to do, or what your assessment is of the value opportunity in UK equities in amongst all this very difficult and challenging and, as I said, murky forecast for the political outlook?
Yeah, I mean, I think the undervaluation in sterling is probably reflective of the fact that UK assets have been shunned by Brexit-phobic overseas investors to some extent. Again, the valuation anomaly isn't dramatic, which is probably what you would expect given markets are reasonably efficient, but I think there's something there. And recently we've seen a better trading performance, partly reflective of a better economic outlook at home, partly reflective of the fact that some big sectors like energy have kind of come back reasonably well. So yeah, it's a reasonably benign background for the UK, subject to all the usual caveats about being quite late cycle.
And final question, outside chance, do you think there's any possibility that Theresa May, on the basis that this deal's got seemingly little chance of passing, that she could pull it and take a different strategy, or is that sort of too late now?
I mean, I suppose you can never rule it out,
yeah,
because she's done it so many times before. And I mean, I think probably the important thing to say is that these votes aren't the final word on the subject. You know, there will be, as I said, they could all be rejected, which is farcical because one of those things that are being voted for must happen, whether it gets voted for or not. And there is this late March summit, the 21st and 22nd of March, which will give the EU the opportunity to perhaps apply a bit more lipstick to the deal, if that's what they feel they want to do. Problem is, they probably don't feel like they need to make many more concessions at this stage. The intense pressure really is upon both the leader of the opposition and the leader of the government to try and get this whole thing resolved, because the thing we haven't really talked about during this podcast is the fact that their parties are to a certain extent rebelling, disintegrating around their ears. So it's in the interest of everyone in Parliament to try and get this resolved, so that they can get back onto more solid ground.
But that it won't get resolved seemingly quite so, and it's quite such a straightforward manner, suggests that we'll be inviting you back before too long, Guy, to give us your latest thoughts on the Brexit process. It would be a delight to have you. To our listeners, we hope you enjoy that. We recognise we're talking a lot about Brexit, but of course it's such an important subject. But do give us any feedback on Twitter referencing hashtag Brewing Podcast. Leave a review on iTunes or SoundCloud or whatever platform you listen to us through. But until next time, many thanks for listening.